I'm Justin Daniels.
And I'm Jody Daniels, and you're listening to Firewalls Don't Stop Dragons.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Firewalls Don't Stop Dragons. I'm your host, Gary Parker. Today we have episode 370 for April 1st, 2024. So I guess, first of all, happy April Fool's Day for those of you that celebrate. I've never really liked April Fool's. I don't know why. Maybe just a little bit of a stick in the mud. I never like lying to people, I guess, was one thing. There's like no good April Fools. I guess sometimes if there's like parody stuff, I guess that's funny. But like, I was never much into practical jokes. Anyway, if you're into that, happy April Fools. Just a reminder, the new patron promo was launched last week, the treasure and coin promotion. The coin part, the dragon challenge coin part, will go through the end of April. So you still got plenty of time for that. But, you know, why wait? I've already got a couple new patrons, so that's fantastic. And the treasure chest part, where I give out some promo codes for some of the products that I tend to like. In this case, so far, we've got promo codes from Proton, which you can use for anything. It's just a credit toward their account. So VPN, mail, calendar, drive, they got several products. Malwarebytes, a free year of Malwarebytes, and also a free year of Portmaster from Savink. So some great products to try out if you haven't tried them before, and this will give you an opportunity to do that. To get all the details, just go to fdsd.me/promo424. And of course, there's a link in the show notes. Okay, so we've got a great interview show for you today. It's one of my rare panel discussions. I guess I got two people. I've never done anything more than two other people, I don't think. But I'm talking to Justin and Jody Daniels, a husband and wife team who have a podcast called She Said Privacy, He Said Security. And they do a lot of work with companies around privacy and security. And so I thought it'd be interesting to pick their brain a little bit and get their take on the state of privacy today, and in particular, how companies today are trying to manage handling privacy regulations. Certainly there are some in Europe, and there are a few state laws around the country, and a little about how they approach security as well. And we kind of talk about why we don't have federal regulation here in the United States, how they're doing things right or maybe wrong in the GDPR, for example. And since they've actually been interviewed on some of the bigger media outlets, I also ask whether or not the media is covering these topics properly. Now, as usual, real quick before the interview, a couple lingo items, a couple jargony things we throw out there that we don't really stop to define. One of them is B2B and B2C. And these are kind of jargony marketing or business terms. B2B is business to business. So this would be a business that would sell to other businesses primarily. And B2C is business to consumer, which is the things that you and I as consumers are more likely to have interacted with. We also briefly mentioned the GLBA, which is short for the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, also known as the Financial Services Modernization Act of 1999, which is probably all you need to know about that. But if you want to look up more, you'll know what that means. So it was a lot of fun talking to these guys. I hope you enjoy the interview. Real quick, just a FYI, Justin had to leave a little bit early, so he's there through almost the entire interview, but you won't hear this happen, but he will actually duck out toward the end, so it's just Jody at the end. So I appreciate her hanging on and helping me finish this up. So enough of me talking. Let's get to my interview with Justin and Jody Daniels. Jody is the founder and CEO of Red Clover Advisors, a boutique data privacy consultancy and one of the few certified women's business enterprises focused solely on privacy. Jody is a certified information privacy professional with over 20 years of experience helping a range of businesses in privacy marketing strategy and finance roles. Welcome to the show, Jody.
Well, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
And Justin provides his corporate clients a pragmatic approach to addressing cyber as a business enterprise risk at every stage in the business lifecycle. He leads breach incident response teams on ransomware and wire fraud cases in industries ranging from medical IT and logistics to manufacturing. Welcome to the show, Justin.
Nice to be here.
Well, it's great to have you guys. I first learned about you guys from your podcast, She Said Privacy, He Said Security. And so why don't we start with that? Tell me a little bit more about how you guys got into the privacy space, and then tell me about what your podcast is about.
So I got into the privacy space quite a while ago. I was at autotrader.com and I was stalking you for cars. We created a targeted ad network. The Digital Advertising Alliance was formed, and that was really my beginning into privacy. Created the privacy program there, then went on to a large financial institution and learned about privacy at a well-established organization. And I left and started Red Clover Advisors to help companies with all their privacy operations and figuring out the nuance of the now growing list of privacy laws. Mm-hmm. That's my story. What's your story? How'd you get into privacy or security?
How did I do that? For me, it was a moment in 2014 where I hosted the Israeli entrepreneurs, like their version of Steve Jobs, for one day, flew from Tel Aviv to Atlanta about his latest investment in cybersecurity and cars. And after spending a day with him, he's like, you know what? You're a really cool ecosystem here in Atlanta. You should really get the word out. And that's when I realized, cybersecurity, I'm already in technology. Maybe this is a place that I should focus. And it all started for me there. I went on a trip to Israel. I put together a CyberCon conference. I've done a TED Talk on cybersecurity and started to make it a focal point because my technology practice spans cryptocurrency, AI, drones, autonomous vehicles, a variety of tech. But what they all share in common is cybersecurity and data privacy concerns.
So tell my audience a little bit about your podcast. What would they hear if they tuned in?
Well, they'd hear a lot of silly banter. And and you had also asked, you know, how did we get started in the podcast industry? So when COVID was first here, we did a lot of webinars together. And before that, we were doing a number of different conferences and thought leadership pieces together. And then we were doing it so often and felt like even in our day job, we were repeating the same thing. We wanted to be able to help spread this message of why privacy and security are important, the really key pieces. And so some people got COVID kids, COVID puppies, COVID renovations. We got a COVID podcast.
Yeah. The pandemic changed a lot of things and spawned a lot of different stuff. Privacy means different things to different people. And I'm always really interested to hear what different perspectives are, and especially from other privacy advocates and evangelists. So particularly when you're speaking to like non-professionals, when you're at the cocktail parties or family dinners or, you know, wherever you're around, quote unquote, muggles, you know, people that are not doing this day in and day out like we tend to do. How do you define privacy to them? And how do you explain, if they don't feel convinced that privacy matters, what are some of your more compelling arguments?
Oh, Justin, you have to go first because you really do like talking about this all moments long. Every moment.
I see. Well, where I typically start with people is we all lock the doors in our house because there's so much valuable that's inside of it that means a lot to us. So by analogy, we live in a world now where data is incredibly important. So in a way, you are the gatekeeper to decide what you wish to share or not share and with whom when it comes to your digital lives, from emails to information on social media about your birthday and things like that. And so I try to get non-privacy people to start thinking about why that is so similar to what goes on in their house, because people are so trained to want the free products, service, and share that privacy has been put in the, as Jody might say, in timeout. And it's become an afterthought. And you're just seeing, especially in the last 30 years, commercial interests wanting to market to us, sell us stuff, wanting our data to highly target us. And people aren't realizing that it's not free. It's coming at a cost. And at a core level, it's your privacy.
So, Jody, like, how would you define privacy? People talk about, it seems so esoteric. It seems so kind of, you know, abstract. How do you bring it home for people to help them understand why it's important?
I tend to go to some of their daily activities, and I always often use marketing. People get still direct mail, and I'll say, you know, did you get XYZ catalog? Did you wonder where that came from? Or some people will say they put their phone down and then they feel like they're getting an ad that was just about what they were talking about. We like to use the specific things, you know, do you have any kind of IoT device, or is your Wi-Fi talking, or is Alexa in there, or Siri, or any? We like to tell the silly story of our experience going into a mattress store, and it was a smart mattress, and we asked all kinds of interesting questions. So I like to try and bring it home with anything that is unique to them. And the marketing piece, and everyone's, oh yeah, I got that catalog. Why did I get that? Where did that come from? And help people understand, well, it's because your data is getting shared and used all over the place.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And this is something I bring up with my audience a lot as well, is that I think there's the virtual world and the real world. We've gotten used to, you know, some basic, you know, levels of security and privacy in our real world that we don't have the instincts for, you know, in the virtual world, because it's just kind of hidden. It's not quite the same. Like in the real world, we wear, you know, belt and suspenders, you know, when we need to make sure that our pants stay up. We install smoke alarms and, you know, wear sunscreen when we go out. These are all things we're used to in the physical world, but there's like analogs to that in the virtual world that we just haven't gotten the instincts for yet.
That's true. And what I would say is a lot of times, especially if I'm doing a presentation, and this works, you know, for anyone, is kind of imagine a day in the life. If you left your house and you had your phone, or maybe you had your smart coffee maker make it for you and your alarm clock, and you've left and you have someone following you down to the coffee, well, let's go with breakfast place here, and then off to daycare and school and work and lunch and yoga and the grocery store and all the other places. At the very beginning of that moment, if you left and had someone with a pad of paper behind you following you, after probably about a minute, you would turn around and say, well, who are you and what are you doing? Or you feel uncomfortable. Right. And every point along the way, in some fashion, data is being collected and being tracked and connected. People tend to get that when they're going through their daily activities, but they wouldn't accept that in the real world, like you had described. They would very quickly say, no, I'm not okay with that kind of tracking.
Right. All right. So what are your top concerns in the near future with respect to people's privacy? Has the threat landscape changed at all in fundamental ways recently? Anything surprised you about some turn of events in recent times? Or has it just kind of gotten worse generally over the last whatever?
I'm going now?
You're going now.
All right. She's smiling at me. That's
your cue.
That's your sign.
Yes. I would say in the last few years, I think, number one, artificial intelligence really scares me. I'm just seeing how powerful ChatGPT really is. I'm going to be doing a presentation, and I had my friends at IBM take my TED Talk and deepfake it, 40 seconds of it. And they did that in under an hour and a half with open source tools. And it basically made me say things that are complete opposite of what I believe in.
Yeah.
So now we head into an election cycle. I already saw the thing about, you know, Taylor Swift. Mm-hmm. And what is going to stop threat actors, or say a nation state in Eastern Europe that we've all probably heard of, from creating these deep fakes, putting them out on TikTok, Facebook, and other places, and swaying people's opinions about a variety of issues? Because the one challenge with technology is it's kind of made us intellectually incurious. And so people get the videos, they have an emotional response to them. They're completely inaccurate, but there's nothing that requires that there be some watermark or something talking about the authenticity of it. So when I look at artificial intelligence, I look at what happened with social media, what happened with blockchain. It's just two examples of the unintended consequences of other technologies, because let's be honest, in the last 40 years, if we connect the dots, the federal government has largely stayed out of regulating broad swaths of areas as it pertains to our digital privacy and digital security rights. Now, that's starting to change, and I'm going to let Jody handle this upsurge in all these state privacy laws. The SEC came out with a law that you're already seeing is having an impact. But by and large, with AI, other than the FTC and the SEC, there's no U.S. laws regulating it. So why do I feel anything different is going to happen when you can see the rush of money going into AI and you look at what happened with other previous technologies that were largely unregulated?
Yeah. Jody, what do you think?
What he said.
Oh, you, please. You can do better than that.
Not She's- really. AI, for me, is my biggest area of concern, the authenticity of AI. And you have photos and you have videos and you have content. Anyone can put content out there. I was having a conversation with my teenage daughter last night, and we were talking about why do certain people have viewpoints and particular topics. And I shared, well, anyone can kind of put whatever they want out there. There's no moderation. And when enough people start to hear particular views, that's where they go. And in the content generation space, if all that's out there, then it's just going to keep generating, you know, on that own content. For large corporations that are taking data and using these different models, I do fear that you'll have certain groups that will have bias in a variety of different areas, you know, finance, health, but even down to shopping and what offer I'm going to get versus someone else. I've seen airlines say, well, we'll use it for pricing. Is that really equitable to charge me more because I'm looking at a particular time, or you've tracked how many times I've looked, therefore you're going to charge me more? I mean, those types of things, you again wouldn't have that in the physical world. Because I can do it in the digital world doesn't mean that I should.
I'm with you. AI bothers me too. And I mean, to me, again, maybe as a technologist, it seems like any tool could be used for good or ill. And they probably will be used for both. But you know, I'm certainly worried that, you know, phishing scams that used to have lots of grammatical errors and poor English and bad idioms and things are now going to be perfect. Because they're going to have ChatGPT generating them. And deepfakes, obviously, is a real problem. There was the Joe Biden audio deepfake that there was in New Hampshire. That's just the tip of the iceberg. Like, we're definitely going to be seeing more of that. I'm actually kind of worried that at some point we might get to the point where we don't trust anything. You know, we're going to get so burned by all these things. Like, I don't know what to trust anymore.
I think that's where we end up needing some type of system that says which is which.
Yeah.
This was AI. This was real. Some type of... I mean, I've seen digital watermarks and something along those lines. It's not here. It's not commonplace. But if you think about certain websites, you know, it has the little secure seal or it has the little trusted at the very bottom. Sometimes there's, you know, 400 of those seals. It gives you a better sense of, okay, I can trust that.
And Jody, you make a good point, because when you look at the EU AI Act or what trustworthy and responsible AI looks like, one of the components of that is identifying when something is, in fact, artificially rendered. And that's where I think possibly the blockchain makes a comeback, because a digital ledger that records transactions that's immutable is kind of tailor-made for this. So it could be interesting to see how AI may play well or whatnot with other technologies. But again, I think you've both identified what the shape of regulation starts to look like. But as Jody can attest, we're in an election year. They're not going to pass any kind of fundamental federal privacy law or AI act. I'm just worried that we have some kind of black swan AI event, and then we're reactive. Say what you want about Europe, but when it comes to AI and GDPR, they didn't do it after some cataclysmic event. They just view privacy and the AI differently, and they were very proactive in what they did.
Yeah, that's good. It's this year in particular, I think, is going to be off the chain. I do worry about it. All right, let's turn to privacy policies. I want to talk a little bit about that. I know that they're basically impossible for customers to comprehend. I've tried myself. I've tried to look at them. I've honestly given up. I'm a smart guy. I'm an engineer. I know privacy, and I still don't read them, because I know that there's just way too many loopholes. It's all legal ease. It drives me crazy. They always come across to me as legal cover for them. And it's not really about me, even though they're trying to make it sound like it's about me. We care about your privacy. They all start that way. But it eventually gets into all this CYA stuff. So what are some of the biggest missteps do you think that you see companies make today when trying to both define and also implement their privacy policies? And maybe more importantly, how could we expect them for us to trust them when they say these kind of things to us and understand them?
Well, let me answer the trust part. I think when someone is engaging with a company, whether it's on a consumer or B2B side, that element of trust shows up in, are you going to deliver on the product and service that I'm buying you for? Do I trust you enough there? And there's a mental checklist everyone's going through to determine yes or no. On the privacy side, that's going to need to be one of those checklist items. What is it about the company that makes you feel really good it's the best product ever? And then what kind of data are they asking you for? And using your sort of typical privacy and security pieces, how do I feel good? Are they asking me for data that doesn't feel right to me? Are they sending me more emails or mailers or things that doesn't seem right? Are they spamming me on text? Do they have any of the trustworthy items that we've just talked about here? Can I understand anything in the privacy notice? I mean, did I just take it from a template and it still has the little brackets in it because I'm a smaller company? Those are my favorites.
Yeah.
When you see that, you know they're not taking it seriously at all. Now, you can absolutely have amazing window dressing and have everything beautiful on the site, and it is hard as someone on the outside. You won't really know what's happening on the inside. But for me, at some point, there's an element of trust that you are engaging, I'm going to buy this product or service, and therefore I'm also going to trust on the data side, trying to use the little clues that we've learned. In terms of the missteps of privacy policies, I think the first one is that companies create them in vacuums. They create in the legal team, and then they don't actually necessarily talk to the product or marketing teams, or they do talk to the marketing and product teams the first time to get it done. They put it on the site, and then that's it. It's never reviewed again. except at the annual basis to change the year so that it met the 1 year requirement.
Right.
That's not the way you should implement a privacy notice, because they are dynamic. Businesses are dynamic. They change. We collect new data points. We sell new things. We try new marketing tactics. We're using it in a different way. They change. You have to have conversations. For me, that's one of the biggest missteps that I'm seeing companies take or not take.
Well, I think people think of these companies as monoliths, like they all know what they're all doing inside there. These companies have often tens of thousands of employees, and even just within the privacy and engineering space, many thousands of people. And the chances that they're actually communicating well between them and consistently is not a given.
That's true. And that, not as an excuse. I definitely think large companies should absolutely know what is happening. Mm. Let's use a small company as an example. I've had many conversations where it is a small team and they don't know what's happening. You have people who say, well, I don't know, so-and-so. Do we collect it that way? Is that what we do? We should find out. Oh, I don't know. That's Harry over there. I don't know. What was he know? I mean, yeah. The number of I don't knows in a conversation on a small company, literally I've had this with 20 people teams.
Yeah.
That's the whole company is the 20 people and they don't know. So you certainly can't imagine it at that larger scale, but that's not an excuse, because you know what? Companies know how many people they have, and they know that they're complying with HR things, and they know how much money is in the bank and their books. This is just one more piece. How many companies would say, you know, I don't really know what our financial picture looks like.
Right.
And probably not too many.
So is there other structural things that we could be doing? Like, should this be part of every shareholder meeting where they're held accountable, these things? Are there processes we could be put in place that would make these companies, you know, be as good about their privacy policies as they are about their financial statements?
I think it's time to talk about the seatbelt.
The seatbelt. Okay. Talk about your seatbelt.
So my question, you know, for you and your audience is, when you get in your car these days, you get in, turn on the car. What's the next thing you do without even thinking about it? It's just what you do. You put on your seatbelt. Well, when you were growing up with your parents or friends or whatnot, did people wear seatbelts?
No.
They didn't. And so the question is, well, what changed? And I promise there's a point. Well, what changed was Mothers Against Drunk Driving educated people about, you know what, wearing a seatbelt saves lives. And then as part of that, laws were passed that I think in every state in this country but one, it's up in the Northeast somewhere, it's like Vermont, New Hampshire, somewhere there. If you don't wear your seatbelt, there are legal consequences for not doing so. So now bringing it back to our digital discussion, how do we make privacy and security the digital seatbelt of the 21st century so that companies now know, much like when we get in our car, that when they design products, when they are worried about their most precious assets, that has to include the data, how it's being secured. And the challenge is think about all the lives that could have been saved had more people worn seatbelts. But now in our accelerated technology space, we need people to learn this faster.
Well, and I think a lot of companies still look at data as a gold mine. They want to mine as much as possible and hoard as much as they can. It's really more like toxic waste. They need to be, you know?
Yeah. But I'll also say that, and I've, you know, in contract negotiations where I'm in a situation where, oh, well, we want to review your cyber hygiene policies and procedures. And we're like, okay, fine, but we're going to do it over a virtual private network, because really, do you want to have that information from us? Now you've just created a potential liability for your company if you have a data breach. So to be honest, you only need this for a very short period of time to check some stuff. Is this really something that you want to hold on to? And I'm starting to have more success with people. You know, I'm like, help me help you. Right. Like the scene from, what movie is that, Jody?
Jerry Maguire.
Yay!
Something, I get an A for a moment. But Carrie, I would also add, you asked about, well, what should companies be doing? I think it's unique to every company, because I think the cadence of updating and what it looks like is dependent on really how often are things changing in the organization and are you acquiring, I mean, what kind of business, what kind of data, but there should be some type of metrics. You know, what are the ways to measure privacy in each company? Should there be something at the board level? I think the board level should be talking about privacy. Absolutely. But if some companies listening might not have a board. Maybe it's just at the executive level. Maybe you're even smaller than that, right? So what is the right measures for your company? But if you're listening and you have no measures, that is not a good number of measures. We want more than zero. And building them takes time. And I really think it should be dependent on what's actually happening. But it could be, how often have we reviewed the privacy notice? Have we bought new companies? Have we launched new products? What type of new marketing campaigns have we launched? And I don't mean, you know, we launched a new social media campaign, one versus 10. Did we do something different in them? How many risk assessments have we reviewed? Have we collected new types of individuals? Maybe we're expanding markets. You know, do we have children's data now, or do we have people in a different geography? All of those are going to be the types of things that you could start to measure.
Well, and you mentioned executives, and people have heard of CEOs and probably COOs and maybe CTOs, but there's actually a chief privacy officer. CPO is a thing that a lot of companies have now. And I've, in my dealings, have met a couple over the years, and in that anecdotal space, they've all been very frustrated. I'm sure that you guys have interacted with CPOs. So what's it like being a CPO today at a company? In my little understanding, it's very frustrating for them that it's a title without a lot of, you know, capability. They're kind of shoved off to the side. Maybe they don't have the ability to make real decisions. So in your experience, and I know you've had much more than I do, what is it like being a CPO today? And does that vary depending on maybe the age of the corporation or the size of the corporation?
I think it varies, but not because of age or size of the corporation, but the tone of the company and how it views privacy. Some companies view it as strictly as a compliance activity, and those that do, who don't view compliance as important, will take the least approach, and those are probably the more frustrated CPOs. The companies who view compliance and take it incredibly seriously are listened to. You have many organizations that are regulated, like financial and health and insurance. Those companies get attention because it's so important. It's just one other slice of compliance. You also have other companies not in those industries who just view compliance. They want to take a very risk-averse approach, and those people also get great attention. If it's an organization where privacy is just this kind of thing, it's annoying and it's in my way, they don't view it as building trust. They view it as an inhibitor to the marketing and the sales activities, and it's a paper exercise. Then again, those companies are not going to give what the CPOs need. Instead, they might give it to the security people because they view that as a different threat than privacy. There are companies who say, oh no, this is amazing. We want to be privacy first. I've seen it from brand new startups to really large companies who recognize this is important. Our customers care about it. I've seen it in B2C and B2B. And then those companies give the type of support that those privacy teams need. Justin, what about you? Apparently, you can't just say she said, like I said earlier.
Why not?
Because I said he said and you didn't like that.
Well, because I was entertained.
Well,
I would say from my standpoint, where I see it come up a lot is when I'm meeting a client for the first time and they've got all kinds of data collection, and I'm always amazed by how they are not keen on what kind of data they're collecting, who they're sharing it with, how the data might be misused. And particularly with growth companies that I work with, you're so focused on getting that deal done, getting that contract signed, that next announcement, getting potentially that next round of funding with an investor, that privacy is looked at as just an impediment. And so it just never surprises me these days, because these companies, you know, privacy is not perceived yet widely as adding value, particularly for companies who are trying to get with the Fortune 500, which is why I think the 14 state privacy laws we have now, the new SEC cyber rules, because you're seeing three macro trends in our world today. One, it's the digitization of the economy. Even when I work on car wash stuff, they collect data. Number two, hey, we're all going to migrate to the cloud. It's so much more efficient. The cloud, the cloud, the cloud. Well, from a privacy and especially a security perspective, the cloud provides a very attractive target, as we've already seen. And then the third one, which is near and dear to this person's heart and mine, is increased privacy and security regulation. And you're seeing all of this play out because you're seeing some of the excesses with privacy coming to the forefront with all the big tech companies. But I'm not prepared to say at this moment, privacy is still a design feature that it needs to be. It's still too much thought of, particularly by growth-oriented companies, as an impediment. We don't want to talk to these people. They're the office of no.
Well, just to play devil's advocate here for a minute, I actually think that the financial incentives are completely just inverted. It's set up to fail. Here in the U.S., since we don't have privacy regulations, there is no downside to collecting and sharing and monetizing all of our data. I mean, the shareholders are demanding growth, right? And the company boards are beholden to them. They have fiduciary responsibility to grow the company and satisfy their shareholders. There's money sitting there on the table, and there's no law saying they can't take it. It just seems to me that that's kind of, without the regulation, how can we blame these companies for doing this?
Well, I feel like that gets back to the trust piece. And what, I mean, the part that I've been speaking for a long time is what do customers expect? What is the trust piece? If I collect all this data and then I use it in a manner that wasn't expected, you've surprised me, then customer backlash is real, whether that's B2C or B2B. People don't want to be misled. They don't want to feel like they were misused or that they were just a pawn in it. When people sign up for certain social platforms and they appreciate that it's free, some people understand that the data is what is supporting that platform. Other people don't. But let's take other areas where you go and you buy something, or you just showed up at a website to decide if you were going to buy something. You're not even sure, or you're going to a site to research something. When all of that tracking is connected, or when you make purchases and all of the purchases are connected, and then that data is shared so that decisions can be made, customers didn't expect that. They expected to go to the site to gather information, to make an informed decision. They either said, yes, I like it, or no, I don't.
And the way I look at it is, a best story for that is, for anyone out there who you have a coffee store, remember, we don't want to have the damsel over here who gets distressed when she buys her first cup of coffee from the coffee store and pays with it by credit card because it's cashless. And literally 5 minutes later, she gets an email from the payment processor saying, hey, we want to give you a coupon. Can you tell us when your birthday is?
Yeah.
That is true. Those are built into the payment processors that the various stores using them can use. And you can see that they're repetitive templates that have been used. So there's a great example. I went for coffee. I just paid with my credit card. I didn't even ask for the receipt. There wasn't the send me the receipt button. It just already has it in as an auto save because it's connected automatically, which I didn't choose. And then I didn't choose to get the emails either from the coffee shop. And no joke, it was truly 5 minutes later. It was, we'd like to invite you to the birthday club. You know what? There's not a law that says that they can't do that, right. But I'm not going to give the information, not just because I'm a privacy person, but because we haven't established any relationship out of trust. Who are you? I didn't even give you my email in the first place, and you've already surprised me. Now, if you escalate that or, you know, extrapolate that to a much bigger kind of data situation, the impact to the customer is going to be greater. I just didn't visit the coffee shop. Okay. Go to somewhere else.
They were too forward with you.
They
wanted to get hitched right away, and they didn't want to date and build trust.
They did not want to date and build trust. That's the way you have to do it.
Well, there was an obvious cause and effect there that caused you to connect those dots. But the actual stuff that's going on is such a huge black box. You know, we only see the tip of the iceberg, and there's so much going on there that we don't see that we can't draw the dots. We don't know that because we drove by this license plate reader, which we didn't see, that this company knows how often we've come to their parking lot or how we've come through their neighborhood, or that information is now also being sold to someone else who knows, oh, you traffic in this area, let's send you a coupon for the subway that's right down the street. We don't see that. If it hadn't happened within 5 minutes, you probably would have had no idea that those two dots were connected.
And I think where privacy really becomes challenging is I've worked in a variety of technologies that are designed with a public safety purpose in mind. So to your point, when you're at the parking lot, so municipalities out there where they have vandalism in a parking lot or police departments that are trying to catch criminals. Well, you can't have police everywhere, but if you have these cameras that have license plate recognition to where the license plate can be recognized, oh, that's somebody who's committed a violent crime and they're able to direct the police, from a public safety perspective, that's a great force multiplier because cities have limited budgets. But on the other hand, if you don't think through how the cameras are interacting and what data they're collecting, what's used with it, my concern is in our pursuit of public safety, which is a very worthy goal, it kind of trumps everything. And we don't really have any kind of discussion about civil rights and privacy and where to kind of create those guardrails. They just get run right over because we're just reacting to the latest public safety outrage, which unfortunately we have too many to choose from, which is very different than what they've done in Europe, because regardless of what you think, they've been, you know, proactive. It hasn't been some cataclysmic event that required it. Like, for example, the Patriot Act, it happened because of 9/11. Mm-hmm. You think of Dodd-Frank, it happened because of 2008. GDPR didn't happen because they had some meltdown. It happened because this was the evolution in how they view privacy.
Well, another thing a lot of people don't think about either is, okay, fine, my local police department is watching out for stolen vehicles or vehicles involved in crimes of these things, but almost surely they are contracting a third party for that service. And that third party probably runs thousands of police departments around the country, and they share that data amongst them as well. And oh, by the way, they might be selling that out the back door to marketers.
And that's where it's important for the municipalities and others to put in their contracts and other things that you are only to use this for the services that you're providing. But one of the challenges, particularly with the public sector, is they don't have the resources. So they don't even know what questions to ask because they've got a city attorney or an IT professional who's being asked to wear multiple hats, and privacy and security, it's its own hat that requires expertise, and they don't have it. So people don't know enough to ask.
Yeah. All right. So you brought up the EU and GDPR. So let's talk a little bit about that, because here in the US, we are woefully behind them in terms of privacy protections. And, you know, GDPR is not perfect. Nothing ever is. No law ever is. It needs to tweak over time. And we learn things like the stupid cookie banners and whatever, right? I mean, we learn, hopefully, and tweak things as we go. But in the US, we haven't even really done that. So I'm curious to hear from your perspective. What do you think is preventing us in the US from having solid privacy regulations? Because I mean, I just was watching the TV today. Congress is roasting Zuckerberg and the guys from TikTok right now. Like as we're recording this, they're getting roasted at Capitol Hill over various things. It seems like both sides of the aisle just hate big tech, and yet we cannot seem to put together, you know, privacy regulations. We can't seem to rein in some of these practices. Is it money and politics is the problem? Is that the classic thing? Or is it even, you know, I hate to get conspiratorial, but, you know, are the intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies saying, you know, cut that out. We need that data. Don't turn that off. Why don't we have federal privacy regulations in the US?
Well, it's probably all of the things you've just described. The answer I typically go with, and I genuinely believe, is I think we can't really agree on anything. Mm. And I do think it's money and politics on both sides of the aisle. You know, if you look at the closest we came in 2022, where we had the potential for a federal law, it really broke down with two main issues, which was private right of action. Can I, the individual, sue? And then which trumps, the state or federal? And now that we have 14 different states, plus many, many more introducing some type of other privacy law, my personal view is we're on our way to mirror the way tax and HR laws are designed. In other words, where you have a state law and then you have a federal law, and in some places you have a local law. And we are seeing local privacy laws in different situations, often for biometric data, maybe even with, you know, AI and when it can be used in different places.
New York City.
Right.
Illinois, Pippa.
Yeah. Yep. Well, Illinois would be at the state level, but New York City would be an example of city, and San Francisco, I think, also has a city one.
Yep.
Okay. And I think there's some others. So I'm hopeful we don't actually end up at the significant city level. That would be very crazy. But I do genuinely think we're going to end up mirroring with the state level. And then even if, well, first off, we do have some federal laws. They're sectoral, right? We have some that cover health for HIPAA. We have education for FERPA. Finance, we have finance and GLBA. Yeah. We have our CAN-SPAM. We have our tech state. I mean, so we do. We don't have the comprehensive one, which would be very helpful to at least perhaps unite definitions. If we were to get a federal one, I just don't think it's going to replace where we are at the moment, especially given how far we've come in this period of time. That's just my opinion. The other view I have is Justin and I have both spent some time with those who have been lobbying for a national data breach law. And if you think about privacy, which impacts a company at every decision point all day long when it's using data, that's really hard, very cumbersome. And on a security level, if you look at the data breach laws, they almost are like the same. They just copied them and pasted a new state name. I mean, with a few changes over the years. And there's no federal data breach law. So if you have a data breach, you have to deal with 52 different data breach notifications here in the US. If we can't agree on that, which is much simpler to deal with, the likelihood, in my opinion, of getting something meaningful at the federal level is a lot smaller. I do eventually think something will be passed. I call it a political dart. Whichever one has the most money in politics is going to win. And we'll determine how valuable it will or won't be. That is my view.
Wow. That was Jody. That wasn't no ChatGPT.
That was no ChatGPT. No Jody GPT.
I think the other thing I would add to what Jody is saying is when you're watching the excerpts from the Senate, look at the senators. It's literally like a retirement home. I mean, the average age is like in the 60s. So here you have all these cutting edge technologies with people who literally grew up like before we had the first computer. Yeah. And they're the ones who are trying to understand this, which even for us is sometimes difficult. So you add that to the mix. And then the other thing is you have people who are at odds for very different reasons. Like, why do the Democrats and Republicans want to get rid of Section 230 that insulates big tech from liability from the content on their platforms? One side says it's censorship. The other side says it's promoting misinformation. That's where we kind of sit today. And as I said earlier, I mean, if we had some type of black swan event with AI, which I hope we don't, but we'll see, that might precipitate legislation. But whenever you're throwing something out there in reaction to an event that's not well thought out.
The black swan events, unfortunately, tend to make us very reactionary. And I think a lot of people would look back at 9/11 and say that we over-rotated, you know, in our response to that. If we had been more proactive, less reactive, we could have been done something a little more reasoned and thought out and protecting of civil liberties. I'm going to bring a couple things back together that we've talked about and get your ideas on this. To me, I think if we can't come together enough to have a solid federal privacy regulation, to me, a next step I think that could be helpful would be at least have transparency. Because I think, again, back to my black box analogy, I think there's a lot of things we really don't understand of what's going on there. And some of that's on purpose. I think a lot of these companies are obfuscating this on purpose. And then it's just so complex. There's so many moving parts to this data gathering and sharing system that it's actually hard to understand what's going on. But I think if we made it more open, if people could actually see how some of these algorithms work, if we had to publish everybody that we're sharing data with, if we had some way to trace data through this massive system of leaks and sharing and selling, I think if we had more transparent people could see, I think that might spur people to more action. What do you think about that? Would transparency maybe be an intermediate step that might enable us to come around to some of these laws?
So wearing my business hat and in a privacy operations hat, I think some of that would be a bit complex. And, you know, thinking about like an algorithm, a company might not want to really give that up. Part of that might be their secret sauce. I do think it's probably a better evolution of a privacy notice and real privacy programs and principles. And right now, companies are struggling with even, we talked about before, a privacy notice. If you make an individual rights request, that's really hard for many companies to figure out. In my mind, probably a step forward would be better transparency of what they're actually doing. I'm not sure looking underneath the hood to all the fine details. I put on my like corporate hat where that's all my proprietary pieces, right? They might not want to disclose all of that. I do think explaining what's actually happening and being really clear on what the choices are and how that's being used in a privacy notice that's usable, understandable. People have flirted with the idea of the nutrition label, right? Something that is consistent, I think, right? Some type of consistent approach, not the GLBA notice. There's a lot of room for improvement based on that version. Those were probably my original pieces. I do think the idea from a data broker perspective and all the sharing of data that is happening, the ability for a user to be able to do it more at a one-time basis and then it cascades out. You know, if I think about do not call, you go once and then all the companies have to go to that list. Something here where at one time I could send it and it would go to all of the different data brokers. That's really the origin behind the California Data Deletion Act, to be able to have the consumer go one time. Something in that vein would make a lot of sense. Right now, a consumer having to go to every site possible or every data broker, that's kind of crazy.
That was really good. I don't know that I have anything more to add. You're just too tremendous.
I love it.
Don't worry, users. I'll be getting in trouble within at least the next 10 minutes. I'll get about 10 minutes of goodwill for that statement.
Well, what we're talking about also would be like a universal opt-out mechanism, a UOM. I don't know if they're trying to pronounce that acronym yet. Right. Global Privacy Controller, what used to be do.track. The companies don't want us to have that capability. They want this notice of consent where we have to find and identify each of the individual things and try to opt out because they know that's impossible. But they really are fighting against some sort of a way for us to just globally say, stop it. Stop sharing my data. Right. I mean, will something like that ever pass?
I'm not sure that's going to pass at a here's the law, you must comply type thing for universal opt-out. I will be honest, those in the digital community still differ on what is even trackable and opt-out. That's why Do Not Track never made it anywhere, because what are you tracking in that definition? The states are putting in, you have to comply with this universal opt-out, and Global Privacy Control appears to be the winner. The piece that I'm thinking about is a bit more of that registry where it might not just be digital tracking, but it could also be my name. You have my information here, and then you've tied it to all these other pieces. For me, it's something along those lines to be able to allow users greater central capabilities. And the first step is the California Delete Act.
All right. So you guys have both been on multiple big media outlets. I'm curious, what do you think of news organizations today? Are they asking the right questions when you go on there? Are they asking you the right questions in this area? Are they covering the important aspects of this when you're seeing news stories around privacy or even, you know, data breaches and things? And regardless, what should they be doing? What kind of role can the media be playing here to make our world better?
Well, I think the challenge with the media today is everything has to be done so fast. It's all about getting out there first and worrying about checking facts later. The other thing is, at least when I've gone on shows, it's 4 to 6 minutes. So it'd be like, let's distill down the Declaration of Independence and 200 years of history in 4 to 6 minutes, and sometimes less than that. And so what I'm saying is, with the digital media outlets where we do a quick interview, you just don't have enough time to get into the issues. So you have to come up with something that's pretty snappy, kind of tells the story in a very concise way. But a lot of this stuff has nuance to it, and you can't get at that. And so to really understand these issues, you have to be well-read, reading a variety of different sources to really piece it together, because interviews can be helpful, but they're really at just a top level. It really can't get into the deeper issues like cookie consents and how you're collecting the data and what you're doing with it. It just says, hey, can you give us 3 tips? Or right. If Moses came down from the mountain, here are the 10 commandments, the 3 most important of which are these. And that's all you have time for.
If only there was like an hour-long podcast or something where you could really dig deep into these subjects, right?
Yeah.
I mean, media outlets have an angle. And I think sometimes they're asking the right questions. But at the end of the day, I don't think all media outlets are all asking the right questions in a balanced approach, which is the definition of journalism. You're supposed to be trying to find the balance.
She's living her Barbara Walters days right now.
All right. So as we start wrapping up today, let's talk about maybe some positive things. What are some maybe we haven't really talked yet about what we call privacy enhancing technologies. That's a term of art, PETs. So what are some of the more promising PETs, and are they being adopted? I mean, there's one thing to have this ivory tower where we've got this really cool idea, differential privacy or whatever. But are they actually being incorporated into products now? And if not, why not?
There are some PETs that are being used. I think they're kind of slowly being more adopted. You know, like pseudonymous identifiers have been around for a while. That's one of the more popular ones. The different kind of levels of encryption are here. And being able to find, I think before people can even use PETs, they have to understand the kind of data that they have and where they can swap it out and what are they doing with it, where that wouldn't be as ideal to do it in the current manner. And instead, we don't actually need the real data right here. Let's do something different so that we can preserve and being able to continue crunching numbers, analyzing whatever it is.
So when you say people use this, so you're actually talking about the corporations, right? Not the yes. consumers. Yeah.
Well, the people in the corporations. So yes. I don't think the actual regular old consumers are not using this right now, but corporations are slowly using them. I think I see more from a financial standpoint, a healthcare standpoint, and then things like clean rooms are being used from a marketing perspective.
What does that mean? I've seen that term thrown around. What is it? What is a digital or data clean room? What's that mean?
The idea of a data clean room in the simplest form is imagine you take data, you put it in a black box. You want other people to be able to have access to that data, but not have the actual access to it. So the black box is a middle company whose sole purpose is to allow all the different people to connect to it. They're not, and then all the people have said, yes, no, that's okay to do that. So I've put it in the box. And I've hashed it in some variety, I've stripped it, and then I let the other people have access to the parts that it's okay for them to do. And the clean room is not using it for themselves.
So it's like a data escrow kind of a thing?
You could kind of look at it like a data escrow. The situation is such that company A is allowing it to be used with company B. So all the people who are participating, either like one-to-one or one-to-many, have said, no, it's okay that this kind of data is used. That's the point of the clean room, is it's been a voluntary raise your hand, I'm jumping in knowing what's happening, as opposed to a data broker where I might sell it and it goes out to whoever, however.
And this clean room is set up by the consumer or by the company that collected the data initially?
All companies. Consumers have no idea about any of this.
Because like Tim Berners-Lee has this notion of solid, right? Where the consumer is in charge of their data. It sounds like the consumer would actually be the one that owns the data and either contracts out or runs their own clean room and then grants access.
I think that could be a future idea. I've seen this idea many times over for years now of it's going to be consumer owned. It's going to be consumer directed. I'm going to have my little data account. I'm going to be able to say, you can have this data. You can have that data. No, you can't have any of my data. I don't think we're there yet. There are some companies that I've heard of that are trying to do that. There's not mass adoption. That's just not where we are. To get there, there needs to be some type of incentive. You might have even heard people say, you have to pay me for my data. Well, what does that marketplace look like? That's flipping the whole thing right on its head. And it, we might get there. We're not there yet.
Are there any other ones like differential privacy or zero knowledge proofs? I mean, are there any other PETs that you see being batted around and actually starting to be implemented?
Those are all ones that I have heard. Those are all ones that I know of companies using. I don't have any first world stories that I could tell you at this moment other than the ones that I've shared. So those are a little bit less used than in the universe that I've seen so far, but certainly around.
All right. So as we wrap up, I'm going to do the thing you just said that everybody always does to you on new shows and ask you for some tips. But I want to get some different ones. I want to get something a little bit more esoteric. If somebody's asking you for resources to learn more about privacy and to be convinced that privacy is important to them, like books or documentaries or even websites or YouTube videos or TED Talks or I don't know, what are some of your go-to references for people that are kind of new to the space that want to learn more about privacy?
Well, I imagine we're talking about from a company perspective, which I tend to send people to a couple different places. I mean, IAPP is the gold mine of understanding anything privacy. I also actually really like the ICO, which is the Information Commissioner's Office. I think their website for understanding what GDPR is really, really helpful and well done. From a marketing perspective, the Digital Advertising Alliance, so aboutads.info, it's one of the oldest self-regulation in the industry and have been an early adopter. They have a consumer section and a company section. So from a consumer standpoint, that's also a really helpful one. And I then kind of say to people, pick the people that you resonate with. There are so many people in privacy who are passionate about different slices of privacy. You have lawyers who are really passionate in the US and globally. You have some that are really passionate about cross-border transfers. You have some that are really excited about data brokers and opting out of everything about that. So it's, in my mind, kind of finding the person that you resonate with. So spending some time on LinkedIn. I have to be honest, I'm not really a YouTube junkie, so I have no good references for YouTube at all. And, you know, there's also a long list of privacy podcasts. Obviously, we are two hosts of them, but the privacy podcast community, in my mind, they all have different flavors. They're all a little bit different. There's not too much that's actually repeated. And I would offer to find the ones there that would be useful for you if you're curious of what they are. Jeff Jokic is a great individual who actually summarizes all of them and also has a company trying to help advocate for consumers owning their own data.
Okay, Jody, I know your husband had to run. Thank you for hanging on. Before we go, maybe what are just some final thoughts you have on privacy in general?
Privacy is hard, and getting this right in companies is a challenge. And many people come to privacy because they're passionate about something. I had a conversation with a team member. They were sharing, they're really passionate for individuals being able to have rights and they want to advocate. When it feels hard in the company, when it feels like you're not able to get what you're looking for, try and keep that end goal in mind, because this is something that affects all of us. And the work that every person is doing day in and day out is for the betterment of our society as a whole. It's about information. And in this digital era, in this age where we're not, it's going to be even more challenging to determine real versus not. Privacy is incredibly important and will continue to be very, very valuable going forward.
Jody, thanks so much for coming on the show. Be sure to tell Justin I said the same. It was great to have you in a very, very informative show.
Well, we really appreciate you having us. Thank you so very much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much again to Jody and Justin for coming on the show. That was a lot of fun. A couple things I wanted to mention real quick, though. I don't think I mentioned this in the interview, but beyond the podcast, they've actually written a book together as well. It's called Data Reimagined, Building Trust One Byte at a Time. Put a link to the show notes in that in case you want to check that out. I want to circle back to a couple things. I didn't want to do these ahead of time. I wanted to kind of hit them at the end. We talked about GPC, which is short for Global Privacy Control. I've talked about this on the show every once in a while. It's maybe been a while since I brought it up. I did have a blog article that I wrote on this. I'll put a link to the show notes if you want to go back and check that out. It's basically like do not track, if you remember that flag from way back that never really took off. Global privacy control seems to be like DNT 2.0, but it has come out in an era where it might actually have some relevance. So anyway, in my blog article, I'll tell you how to turn that on in your browser and check to make sure that it's on, because sometimes it's not as easy as it should be. We also did talk about the IAPP, that is the International Association of Privacy Professionals, along with the aboutads.info and your ads choices. If you're interested in those, I put links in the show notes, of course. And finally, Jeff Jokic, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. I think you said Jokic. I've talked about Jeff before because he maintains a list of top privacy podcasts. And I recently placed quite highly in that list. I was quite proud of that. And I really love to get Jeff on the show sometime, actually. I'll reach out to Jeff and see if we can make that happen. for the patrons on Thursday. Of course, I've got a little bonus content. Justin, as I said, had to leave. So I asked Jody a couple extra questions. We talk about their book and not just kind of what it was about, but also the process around writing the book. And then we dug a little more deeply into how privacy and security organizations work inside modern companies, or don't, as the case may be, and how they often get short shrift and why that is, and maybe how that could be fixed. So real quick, looking ahead, next week we have the mailbag episode. So just FYI, that was recorded earlier and it's not a news show. So if there's any major news breaking between now and next week, it will not be covered. You'll have to wait until the next news show, unfortunately. And I have several other interviews waiting to be aired. But the one that'll come out after the mailbag show will be with Joe Mullen from the EFF. And we'll talk about the Kids Online Safety Act. So again, the patron promo is going on right now. Check it out at fdsd.me/promo424 if you're interested in getting one of my super cool, highly collectible, security-enhancing dragon challenge coins. They are really cool. And also, maybe get one of those really cool prizes from the treasure chest. So that's it for this week, everybody. Thank you for tuning in. Stay safe out there. And until next week, as always, don't get caught with your drawbridge down.